This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. President Trump is warning Saudi Arabia of severe punishment if it's found that Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered by Saudi agents, as many believe. Khashoggi has not been seen since October 2nd, when he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Mr. Trump was interviewed on the CBS TV program 60 Minutes, which airs on Sunday night in the U.S. We have a report from the AP's Ben Thomas at the White House.
President Trump says he would be very upset and angry if it turns out that Saudi Arabia ordered the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But he says they deny it every way you can imagine. Khashoggi, a U.S. resident and critic of the Saudi government, was last seen entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, more than a week ago. Since then, reports have emerged that he may have been killed while inside the consulate. In an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes, the president says the Saudi government could be behind Khashoggi's disappearance and vows there will be punishment for whoever is. As for calls from Congress for sanctions against Saudi Arabia, including an end to arms sales, the president says that could hurt American jobs, and he doesn't want to lose an order like that. Ben Thomas, Washington.
President Trump is getting set to extend a welcome home at the White House. That will be Pastor Andrew Brunson's first stop back on U.S. soil after being freed from a 2-year captivity in Turkey, where he was charged with spying and terrorism. Brunson earlier today underwent a medical checkup at a U.S. airbase in Germany. President Trump today thanked Turkish President Erdogan for Brunson's release, and he denied there were any negotiations to gain the release of the 50-year-old Turkish-born evangelist. Said Mr. Trump, quote, "I don't make deals for hostages." Amid hundreds of thousands of power outages, the massive cleanup from Hurricane Michael plods forward, even as the search for victims continues, with Florida as the focal point. Michael's death toll stands at 17. It's expected that number will go higher. This is VOA News. The United Nations Children's Fund says a militia fighting Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria has released more than 800 of its child soldiers. UNICEF is voicing the hope the action will be followed by further such releases. A seat on the United Nations Human Rights Council has been granted to the Philippines. This despite widespread charges that Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's anti-drug campaign operates far outside the rule of law. Human Rights Watch calls Duterte's war on drugs a killing frenzy, which has left thousands dead. There have been new developments in the mysterious death of a U.S. diplomat in Madagascar. We get the story from Mike Gracia in Washington.
Newly unsealed court records show the FBI and the State Department have opened a homicide investigation into the September 22nd death of U.S. diplomat Kevin Webb in Madagascar. Webb was a human resources officer who had been posted to the embassy in Madagascar since July of 2017. Court filings reveal a foreign national who was spotted trying to leave Webb's apartment on the night of Webb's death was arrested by authorities. The suspect admitted he fought with Webb in the apartment and that Webb collapsed. Federal authorities have not released the cause of Webb's death or a possible motive in his slaying. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A United Nations employee in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo has tested positive for Ebola, the first such incident during the current outbreak. This after health officials warned about a troubling rise in new Ebola cases. The World Health Organization's Tariq Yasarovich.
So this really indicates the shift where the epicenter of outbreak is, from Mangina to the city of Beni, that basically has seen three-quarters of all cases in past weeks.
There is a new warning on the dramatic effects and potential effects of climate change. The World Food Program says unless the pace of global warming is slowed, there will be a devastating effect on agriculture and the ability of people to feed themselves, leading to an enormous increase in world hunger, which is extremely serious already. This year, it's estimated that upwards of 820 million people go to bed hungry every day. Russia's top diplomat says the decision to recognize the Ukrainian Orthodox Church's independence from Moscow is a Washington-backed provocation. Observers say the move actually is a Ukrainian victory, considering Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea and its continued support for separatists in eastern Ukraine, where violence has claimed thousands of lives. To keep up to date on all the news, you can go to voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We have seen a genuine commitment by the CJTF, and we're not seeing any new, or we don't have any indications that there are any new recruits.
A Nigerian militant group releases over 800 children from its ranks.
Legal precedent which dismissed that philosophy of constructive resignation. So it's not workable in the current scenario, and the government knows that.
The Malawian government terminates the contract of former First Lady Calista Mutharika and two others.
We are actually with a team trying to analyze the data. How soon will it be published? We can't say yet. We are still working on making sure that the report that comes out really reflects what the volunteers saw in the field.
And Transparency International sharply denies sending poll observers to monitor the recent Cameroonian presidential election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United Nations Children's Fund says the Nigerian Civilian Joint Task Force, or CJTF, a militia, has released 833 children Friday, formed in 2013 to fight Islamic militant group Boko Haram. The CJTF agreed last year to end child recruitment and to release those it holds. According to UNICEF, 40% of the children released were 15 or younger. Meanwhile, the UN humanitarian agency says it will continue to support the social and economic reintegration of the released children. For more, I reach Milen Kidani, chief of the child protection at UNICEF in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
This is a big moment for us and for the children in Nigeria, as this is a good start sign that the Civilian Joint Task Force is taking this very seriously and releasing these children.
So as they release the children, what happens to them and what are their current state at the moment?
So now that they've been released from the CJTF, they are members of their own community, and we are supporting them, UNICEF is supporting them with other partners, implementing partners such as Search for Common Ground, in order to ensure their sustained social and economic reintegration.
How long have these children been in the ranks of the militia group?
The CJTF was formed sometime in 2013, and some of these children have been with the group for a longer period, some only as short as a couple of months. And really, their level of association also ranges in terms of whether they were acting in supportive roles, whether acting as guards or cooking or fetching water or what have you for the adults. And some of them may have been more actively involved, including use of arms. So the reintegration process involves really first profiling these children, understanding who they are, what their interests are, making sure that we are trying to make what their dreams and hopes and aspirations are, make those services available for them. Some of them want to go to school. Some of them have never been to school and want to start. Some of them want to return. And some may actually want support in some livelihood skills. And we make sure that we do this not just with these children, but as well other children within their communities to ensure a proper support is provided across other community members as well, not just these children.
I know the process of reintegration is cumbersome and rigorous, but how long is this process practically?
So within the first 6 weeks, we make sure that these children are involved in some activity, whether it's setting up some psychosocial peer-to-peer groups or making sure that we know whether they go to school or the livelihood skills, as I spoke to. And that starts immediately. We want to make sure that we are really building on the skills and talents that are already existing with those children, so that they have a much more sustained support. The one-off support that any partner can provide is not enough, and it's important that we set them up so that they can really do something positive and constructive and productive with their lives, rather than turn to any armed groups, non-state or otherwise, in order to avoid and mitigate those risks of them returning to that lifestyle.
Are there any indications or commitment from the militia group to release every child that it has in its ranks?
Absolutely. From the moment that they signed the CJTF action plan in September 2017, so almost a year ago, from that moment on, that was a formal commitment by the CJTF to stop the use and recruitment of any more children, as well as release those that are among their ranks. And I have to say that UNICEF, alongside all the other partners that have been working with us, we have seen a genuine commitment by the CJTF, and we're not seeing any new, or we don't have any indications that there are any new recruits. And all those that have been listed, we're verifying to make sure they actually were were somewhat involved. And those that have been, we provide that support.
Milene Kidane is the chief of the child protection at UNICEF in Nigeria. She spoke with me from Abuja. The Malawian government has terminated the contract of three public officers, including former First Lady Calista Mutharika. The terminations come after the officers defected from the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, to the opposition United Transformation Movement, or UTM. The opposition UTM is led by Vice President Saulos Chilima, who recently resigned from the ruling DPP. To learn more about the contract terminations, I reach Vincent Kondwi, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi in the capital, Lilongwe.
Section 193 of the Constitution of Malawi, subsection 3, stipulates that anyone working for the government or holding a position in the civil service shall not promote the interests of any political party or any political organization. If they want to interest of a certain political party, they need to resign from their government position. Again, the law prescribes that those people who hold positions which influence the policy formulation of the government or how the government conducts its business, those people are not allowed to take part in active politics. Now, based on Section 193, the Constitution of the Republic of Malawi, the government is within the framework, within the legal framework in enforcing the law.
Some Malawians are saying this appeared to be politically motivated because these three people were staunch allies and members of the ruling party until they joined an opposition movement led by Vice President Saulos Chilima. So is this politically motivated is the question people are asking.
Yes, it is very much politically motivated because when these people are being appointed to this government position, they are already active members of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. Now, because now they are associating with the opposition, the UTM, which is being championed by the vice president. That is the main reason why people are saying it is politically motivated. And the other thing that you need to know is that there is the direct Mahut Chimwemwe Shipungu, who is an active member and holding a political party position within the ruling DPP. The current Attorney General, Charles Muhango, is also a member, an executive member of the ruling DPP. Why are these people not being fired from their position? Firing of these people, they're being targeted just because they are supporting the cause of the vice president who has broken away from the ruling DPP.
So how are Malawians reacting to this latest political development?
The common understanding is that there is a selective application of the rule of law. The government chooses whom to punish or whom to reward using the law. It is clear that those supporting the government, the ruling party, the DPP, are not being punished. They are being rewarded with government positions. But those who are having different political colors from those of the ruling DPP are being targeted now because they are no longer members of the ruling DPP.
There are plans to revoke the constructive resignation of Silas Chilima for absenteeism and insubordination. How can this happen, and is this legally possible?
I think that is not possible because we have precedents. During the time of Bingu wa Mutharika, the late President Bingu wa Mutharika used the same idea to dismiss the then former Vice President Kassim Chirumba. And the courts ruled on that one. Possible for someone who does not voluntarily express his resignation to be forced to resign based on that principle. So there is legal precedent which dismissed that philosophy of constructive resignation. So it's not workable in the current scenario, and the government knows that.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me for a long way. Transparency International has sharply denied that it sent a group of poll observers to monitor the recent Cameroonian presidential election. The state-run broadcaster interviewed members of the alleged group who say the October 10 vote was credible and transparent. However, the anti-corruption organization called the report false and untrue, saying it did not monitor the election. To learn more about the poll observers, I reached Lucien Nyasi, executive director of Transparency International in Cameroon.
We convene the press and other civil society organizations to a conference to launch our campaign, I Protect My Vote, to present the platform and how it works. So before that event, we were approached by a member of Agence Cameroon Press. So I requested to be invited to come and know about the platform. That is how, during the conference, like any other observations, they were present at the conference, but not the observers that actually made statement on TV. So during the conference, there are some communication tools that have been developed and shared among all the participants. And I must say that beside them, we were approached by other civil society organizations to present the platform to their observers.
Are you saying that those that were interviewed on national TV broadcasts throughout Cameroon or the news claiming that they represent Transparency International do not come from Transparency International?
I confirm they do not come from Transparency International, neither from Transparency International Cameroon.
So have you registered your official protest to ELECAM or the authorities in Cameroon? Because this is a fraud, as some people say.
So far, what we did is to make sure that we bring in, as Transparency, the right information to the public opinion at the international and national level. You can see that Transparency International reacted through Twitter and the website to say they do not recognize those observers. We also made a declaration here at the country level to say we do not recognize those observers. So far, these are the steps that have been taken so far to make sure that we put the truth in front of everybody.
What steps did you take in monitoring the presidential election, if I may ask you that way?
Yes, we did not apply for any accreditation at the country level to monitor elections. What we did, we worked on a concept of voters observers. What does it mean? We invited some young people, Cameroonian, I must underline that aspect, to also volunteer to observe. So what happened that day is that we worked with volunteers that are voters, and they agree to, after their vote, to stay around, move around in some polling stations to send back the information on the platform if at all they witnessed any irregularities or fraud.
What feedback did you get from them, and how soon will Cameroonians know the information they provided to you?
Yes, concerning of how soon, we are still working on analyzing the data. We are conscious that, I must say something about the platform. The idea is not only to report, but is to report with proofs. So what we are doing now is to make sure that the data we received are analyzed, and we distinguished what is the right information from what is wrong. So far, we received close to more than 300 alerts from those volunteers on the field. Some came through the platform, some came through SMS, and some came through WhatsApp. So we are actually with a team trying to analyze the data. How soon will it be published? We can't say yet. We are still working on making sure that the report that comes out really reflects what the volunteers saw in the field. So people will be invited at the moment. We believe it is the right time to present the report.
Lucien Nyasi is the Executive Director of Transparency International in Cameroon. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Food program warns climate change will have a devastating impact on agriculture and the ability of people to feed themselves. WFP forecasts a huge increase in worldwide hunger unless action is taken to slow global warming. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The World Food Program warns progress in reducing global hunger is under threat by conflict and the increase in climate disasters. For the first time in several decades, WFP reports the number of people suffering from chronic food shortages has risen. This year, it says 821 million people went to bed hungry, 11 million more than the previous year. Gernot Laganda is WFP's chief of climate and disaster risk reduction. He notes the number of climate disasters has more than doubled since the early 1990s. He says extreme weather events are driving more people to flee their homes, leading to more hunger. He tells VOA the situation will get much worse as global temperatures rise.
We are projecting that with a 2-degree warmer world, we will have around 189 million people in a status of food insecurity more than today. And if it is a 4-degree warmer world, which is possible if no action is taken, we are looking beyond 1 billion more. So there is a very, very strong argument for early and decisive climate action.
Data from this year's State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World report by six leading UN agencies show the bulk of losses and damages in food systems are due to drought, and most of these disastrous events occur in Africa. Laganda says the number of people suffering from hunger because of climate change-induced drought is rising, particularly in Africa and Latin America. He notes that until recently, progress in Asia had led to a reduction in world hunger, but that trend has slowed markedly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Over 40 bodies have so far been recovered, and about 400 people are believed to be missing after mudslides swept four sub-counties in Bududa district in eastern Uganda. Rescuers were still digging through the rubble, and local officials say the death toll is expected to rise. Among those feared killed are pupils of Sumejini Academy, whose makeshift premises were washed away and buried in the rubble. The mudslides were triggered off after a downpour that started around 11 a.m. and lasted about 4 hours on Wednesday. Simon Peter Waluku is a journalist with STEP, a radio and TV station in Mbale. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him for an update on the situation.
Right now, the situation is like government has now come in with some aid, and they are trying to find a way of helping the survivors. First of all, with a few things around, like, for example, they have come with some mattresses, they have come with some food stamps and things like that to find a way of helping the survivors. But also, they are trying to intensify the search of the bodies that are still buried under the soil.
Do we know how many people so far have been recovered, bodies that have been recovered? How many people are dead so far?
Yeah, actually, the bodies that have been recovered are approximately around 40-something.
There are concerns about the school children who are in a school that was affected. What's the fate of the search for them?
Yeah, now what happened is that this water swept the soil from up the mountain, came and swept the trading center, then the school that we talked about, and washed the soil, including whatever on the ground, to the rivers. And all of these few days, because there has been some rain, the waters were at a terrible speed, and therefore it becomes difficult to recover some of these bodies. We realize that some have been recovered as far as the Mbale district, which is like a second district after Bududa district. So far, the hope of recovering life is really diminishing, but the neighboring districts, the people, the survivors, and the local police have tried whatever they could, but still hope to find life is still less.
This is a remote area. The roads are largely impassable, and the rain, is, as you say, has made matters worse. How is the government trying to salvage what is left of the place?
Actually, in addition to that place being a remote area, when this incident happened, it also swept away the bridges that could connect the places there. So right now, it is very difficult for people who are this side to cross the other side where the incident occurred. That is another issue which has slowed down the process of recovery. But last time, the Minister of Disaster and work out ways and bring like choppers on the ground to see if they can help, and said people who can help intensify in the recovery.
This is the second time such a disaster is happening in that area. Some time back, the same thing happened. Was there anything that was done to mitigate the effects of this disaster?
I want to say that a lot of things were put in place at that time, but I want to also say that I think the government relaxed a little, because there have been warning escarpments, like the land has been cracking, so people had fears that any time this thing might happen again, and it leads to alarm to the government, even through their local leaders. But the response of the government has always been slow. So they tried during that time in 2010, and they relocated a few to Kiriandongo district, but again they stopped there. So I think the problem is about the delay, or the government relaxed a little. But yesterday, the Minister of Disaster Preparedness talked about securing some funds to see that the survivors are moved from that place, and also those who are in prone areas.
Simon Peter Waluku is a journalist with STEP, a radio and TV station in Mbale. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Mbale, eastern Uganda. are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, most people in Lesotho want to limit the position of prime minister to a maximum of 2 terms in office. They also want the leader of that post and other government officials to be more accountable. Currently, there's no constitutional limit on the number of times officials can serve. The findings were contained in a recent survey by Afrobarometer. It's a non-partisan research network that conducts public attitude surveys on democracy, governance, economic conditions, and related issues in Africa. For more on the survey, I reached Dibuseng Malipani, national investigator for AdVision Lesotho, the Afrobarometer's partner.
The current system is like a Westminster system. Normally, the prime minister is elected in the parliament. So what usually happens is that the leader of the party with majority in parliament then becomes the prime minister. So that means if that party keeps winning elections and it has the same leader, then that leader can be the prime minister, like the former prime minister, Bakari Tamusisidi, was prime minister for 14 years before he was out in 2012. But this is, according to Basotho, it's not good if you can have somebody perpetually.
Why do they want things to change? Why do they want a constitutional amendment, if I may ask?
For that reason, that you should not have somebody who can be there for 20 years legally, because his party is being elected into office. So if the party doesn't change the leader, then it means that person can be, you know, for 4 terms can be there. So it's not good. You know, people just staying in office forever and ever.
I understand the people of Lesotho, Basotho as they call them, Dibuseng, want more accountability from their leaders.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this.
Yeah. You know, what is democracy if the government cannot be accountable? This is what happens, then your vote doesn't mean much. You put people in that's all you do is put them in the office. Then they can do as they like. So for instance, you find a situation where somebody doesn't even follow the decisions of the court, for instance. So we don't want that. That is not democracy. So that is why then people would like to see an accountable government which adheres to the tenets of the rule of law. It's very important. We have seen, I think, you know, in the past 5 years, we have seen 3 elections. After 2012, there was one, and then there was one in 2015. And after the 2015 one, really, even though it was a properly elected government, a lot of things happened which did not make Basotho happy, including people getting killed, some soldiers being incarcerated, accused of mutiny, the courts saying, you know, issuing court orders for those people, you know, to be released, but not being released.
This calls for a constitutional amendment, what majority of Basotho want. What has been the reaction of the government under Tom Tabani about this? And do you anticipate any time soon of this call for a constitutional amendment to meet their demands or what they want to see in Lesotho?
This government, when it came into power, it was supposed to get the reforms process going, which came about from SADC recommendations or decisions in the past government. So right now, they are grappling with issues of the opposition, which is saying it's not going to be involved with the reforms. But this process should have actually have started by now to look at issues of security, the constitution, the judiciary, the public service, among others. But it's supposed to be an encompassing process which should involve all sectors of the population. So they're supposed to be on the card. So these findings from Afrobarometer should become one of the inputs into this.
Individual Mosotho say that they can't even get information from their government if they request it, and they want this also to change. How difficult is it to get information from public institutions?
you know, sometimes people, you know, in government think they don't owe the public anything. So you can find that can be very difficult to get information if you want, even though by right you should be able to go anywhere and request this information. So people want to be more informed and have access to the information. There's, you know, information which you expect to be in the public domain, but sometimes can be very difficult to get.
Dibuseng Malipani is the national investigator for Ad Vision Lesotho, the Afrobarometer's partner. She spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, says more than 40% of conflicts worldwide involve between 3 and 10 parties. Many of them have loose command structures, making it harder for humanitarian groups to identify leaders and allow the delivery of emergency relief. Today, the ICRC is using a new approach for identifying group leaders and encouraging them and their fighters to curb violence against civilians and to respect international humanitarian law. VOA's William Eagle has the story from Washington.
A study by the ICRC looks at ways that humanitarian organizations can curb violence and encourage cooperation among a range of armed groups, from centralized state militaries and ideologically driven groups to those with fragmented leadership influenced by local values. The more centralized groups tend to be well-trained and disciplined, with rules and values established in doctrine and enforced by top commanders. These include national militaries and ideologically disciplined groups that are not supported by government resources and infrastructure. Among them are the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and past African liberation movements. The study found that military in some countries were more likely to be influenced by instructors with combat experience as well as knowledge of international humanitarian law, or IHL. It also found that group values, such as warrior's honor, tend to discourage soldiers from acts of violence against civilians, including rape and other abuses. Dr. Fiona Terry is the head of the ICRC's Center for Operational Research and Experience in Geneva.
The norms of restraint really need to be socialized much more into the military. It's got to go beyond just the socialization in you can't do this, it's against the law. Respect for the law gains a lot more traction if you're able to make it about the identity of the soldier. It's not what I do. I don't do it because it's against the law. I don't do it. I don't violate IHL because it's not who I am.
The ICRC says a different approach is needed for armed groups with loose or fragmented leadership. Many smaller groups have little, if any, formal training in curbing violence and protecting human rights. The study found that decentralized groups often have external influences, including the local community, which may either want less violence or may encourage retaliation against lawbreakers. The report looked at two jihadi groups in northern Mali, Ansar Dine, Defenders of the Faith, and Mujal, the Movement for Oneness and God. They claim adherence to Al-Qaeda, but practice different forms of violence. One used suicide bombers, the other used sexual slavery. The ICRC found that the degrees and types of violence could be mitigated or exacerbated by community influence. It could also be reduced by the influence of Islamic law and local Sharia courts. Brian McQuinn is the advisor for the unit that's responsible for global affairs and non-state armed groups for the ICRC. He says using religious traditions can help humanitarians and armed groups find common ground for conversation on values.
So one of the issues that comes out very clearly is this connection between Islamic law and IHL, international humanitarian law. And it turns out there are a lot of similarities, and one of them has to do with the way in which prisoners are treated. And Islamic law is very clear on this one. It has sort of very clear dictates that are quite similar to IHL around, you know, no torture, and being treated in a humane way, all of these things that one would expect. And so this often can be a source of dialogue and a source of interaction on some of these subjects.
Some decentralized groups are made up of local fighters who are embedded in the community and are mobilized only temporarily. That is the case in parts of South Sudan, where the ICRC studied cattle herders and pastoralists among the Dinka and Nuer. Humanitarians found that some norms of restraint were transmitted by culture, like cattle camps, where young men learned to raise livestock. Others were influenced by prophets and spirits. Fiona Terry explains.
In the Nuer tribe, there is the sort of the Nuer spirit is the bad blood. And if you commit atrocities, then you are pretty much damned. But you could perhaps in the past have had prophets reinstating the good blood. But it seems that for many of these fighters, it's gone too far almost, and they sort of have abandoned the idea that they are redeemable, and therefore the violence has spiraled.
Terry says it's not clear if this or other customs could be revived in an effort to encourage restraint, or if traditions could be used to introduce concepts of international humanitarian law. The ICRC study provides its project leaders with a simple blueprint to help identify the differences in discipline, leadership, and values between formal armed groups and those with looser or local leadership. It says identifying and negotiating with those who influence combatants can make it easier for humanitarian groups to deliver relief and staunch violence against civilians. Red Cross officials say that idea couldn't be more timely. They say more armed groups have emerged in the last 7 years than in the last seven decades. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Can you remember, say my mewa? No, you this your love away me wa. Girl, I'm feeling you. Can you remember, say my mewa? No, no, no. Akata karia ina bali mi titiem na bahalia mebe mi papo na sala ke ba ya wa your features are mega omana na hala or na hawa asamo wa mama afunge na sele kwa lidi kuka agama you can live good for call again pack kwa ogoda fi mano e chota gen at kwa mana nwa watch kwa sometimes in nature how the boy go dey me will be muba pepe never loved another like him one baby juice we tell me fan na wan won if an ss come on agi ali sana wan kana maka kaido nemu ya namba nemu ya control
Can you remember, say my mewa? No, you this your love away me mewa. Girl, I'm feeling you. Can you remember, say my mewa? No, 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 you this your love away me mewa. Yeah, your body go banana, body go me for the banana. I'm feeling you, ta ta ta, and real life. Say body go banana, body go for me banana. I'm feeling you, ta ta ta.
Wow.
And we like food.
Yeah. Oh, tell me your secret, I won't tell. Eh? If you bunuku na kumbe, no na ebu munga mafuli akame ibu dumbe. Eh? She ma make your hair swell. One bunu bi sagile koli mo high me no give bole mo screw seven on the phone mo. And you anyway me mama change the good to turn mo. You can pretend my body, my money and the soul mo. So give body no be mo. I promise you, baby, I'm gonna keep up. Iru gama kimwe riru ti alafya. No tene kwa lomu kwa semo na mona gige bitela ni akanka. E mana wan kena maka kailua. Nyamu ya namba, nyamu ya control. Mine can attack, Kaido. Did you marry me? Did you control?
Can you remember? Say, my mewa.
I'm gonna try, say, what?
No, you this your love. We may me wa. Girl, I'm feeling you. Can you remember? Say, my mewa. No, no, no. No, you this your love. We may me wa. Yeah. Everybody go banana. I am in for the banana. I'm feeling you, ta ta ta. And we life. Say everybody go banana, I eat for me banana. I'm feeling you, ta ta ta, and we life. Oh,
hey, man, oh, you my honey. want to elevate. Ori mi kole abane. I want bad belle, want to suffocate. With the bad doing the jollificate. All I told be I'm a party with you. Oh, I told be I'm a party with you. What the told be I'm a party with you. Party with you. Yes, I'm a party with you.
wasted. No bung manly, then it can walk the mystery. No bung a faggy pend in the lace, the mystery. No bung a to browse on flick, the mystery. No bung a nigga next week, the mystery. I'm but chasing goon when I'm a goat. Give na cake, don't bumble la penny. I'm but chasing goon when I'm a goat. The mystery. No bunga mi gana next week. The mystery.
Oh, no, my.
that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, the one who throws the stone forgets, but the one who is hit remembers forever. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.